Monday, January 29th, may have been a sort of a benchmark day in the history of the Lyndon Johnson Library. But first, early in the morning, Fez came over and we talked about my attending Ford's Theater. I had decided against it over the weekend. I will be leaving for Austin at 7. I do not know whether it's the right decision. I would have adored being there at the opening. But it is quite a mix. Ford's Theater and its history, and such volatile characters as Harry Belafonte, disciple of Stokely Carmichael, I'm told, and at least two or three other militant anti-war figures among the performers. I might just mess up the opening, so I am not going. But the important meeting of the day began at 10 o'clock in the morning. First, a session in the Lincoln sitting room with Dr. Stanton and Dr. Grover, Dorothy and Juanita sitting in. We talked to Dr. Stanton about the acquisition of network programs in which the president appeared, documentaries strategic to his administration and its aims and the big events of the times. Only he, Stanton at CBS, keeps the film library and regularly sends to us a copy of the most germane things for our own LBJ library. Now the question is how to acquire them from the other two networks. They are expensive, will mean digging back. We're much more likely to get them to make and give us copies of everything that from now on, and to go to the expense and the research of working backward from January of 68 till November of 63. Dr. Grover will prepare an inventory of those we have and those we want. He will send it to Dr. Stanton, and Dr. Stanton will explain to the other networks what we want and get an answer from them. If the answer is no, somehow we must find the money. And I hope we can even include some of the programs that I have appeared in. Occasionally, far from always, they send us a copy. Then at 11, we moved into the tree room, which I think of very personally as my board of directors room, well seasoned with meetings of Head Start groups and conservation groups, and those of us who put together the exhibits at the little house in Johnson City. Now, this biggest program of all, the library. Today's meeting was the audio-visual committee, composed of Dr. Stanton and Leonard Marks and Jack Valenti, and of course, Dr. Grover, Juanita and Dorothy, and Busby. The main business of the day was to have these specialists in audiovisual media, Stanton, Marks, and Valenti especially, see and evaluate the proposed exhibit plan. Arthur Drexler, whose brainchild it was chiefly, Bunshaft and Max Brooks were on hand to present it to us. We put the model on the big table and took off the lid, and Drexler explained the arrangement on the ground floor, and then on up into the great hall. And here is where we hit trouble. The two pylons, one on each side of the great stairway, on which there would be screens roughly the size of the drapery right there in the treaty room where we were, something like 8 by 15 feet, were eyed askance by Dr. Stanton, and in turn, Marks and Valenti. They came into question as being functional. Drexler had spoken of a movie from 3 to 5 minutes. I had said you couldn't tell any story in that length of time. It would have to be 10 minutes or more. Could you, asked one and then another, effectively tell a story there in the great open hall? Could you screen out the noises so that people looking at other exhibits in the great hall wouldn't be disturbed, and vice versa? Was the screen big enough to be functional? Design-wise, they could see why they put it there. I have no interest in any design that isn't functional. One by one, they agreed the pylons would have to go. Then what of using the whole rear wall, where the great seal of the United States was, as a screen? But you couldn't stand in front of it, because there was the vast, empty stairwell. Along about 1 o'clock, I ordered in sandwiches and coffee and milk and cookies, and we ate while the discussion continued, and it grew pretty heated at times, actually as doubtful as I had been of Arthur Drexler and his being understanding and really in the current of what we wanted in this museum library. I felt a sudden sympathy for him. Mr. Bunshaft is so determined and overbearing. You get the feeling this is his building, not ours. One point we did all agree on and applaud. That is, the vast display of the papers in their red bindings with the white titles behind the glass wall. It can be magnificent. Whether it's too big a price to pay for the concept of the Great Hall remains to be seen. So much space is devoured by the stairwell. Yet it is required, I suppose, to give the impact of walking up and seeing all of these pages of history, 3 decades in the life of a nation and a man, dramatically displayed. Mr. Bunshaft had envisioned an enormous, outsized statue or bust of the president at the top of the stairs. Yesterday, I had agreed there had to be some focal point there, but it could not be this, not at least until he was out of office, and maybe never unless we can get a really great one. I was disturbed, too, by Bunshaft's referring to the beautiful walls, the Carrara marble, on which nobody can ever come along and hang paintings. Quite likely, this is best in the Great Hall. It definitely is not in many portions of the library. This will have to be resolved. I was concerned at the lack of elasticity in the proposed display areas and cases. They did sound beautiful. Bronze and glass, beautifully designed against the Carrara walls. But they did not sound plastic, changeable. This makes me uneasy. It is as though we were trying to make a shoe for a foot we didn't know the size of. And yet we are fighting the necessity of telling the contractor where to put the electrical outlets within the next 6 or 8 weeks. Our big problem is that we are pioneering. There is no prototype of a presidential library. There are only 3 or 4 in existence, and none so well done that you would want to copy them. None tells the story of the decades and the changes and the interaction between a man and the government and the whole people. And everything we all say about it is so nebulous, and yet we have to pin it down into a certain number of square feet with electrical outlets, and soon. The words got a good deal heated, and I'd hate to hear the things Mr. Bunshaft has to say about me and my determination to have some small portion of space where we show social life in the White House. And that exhibit can be changed in the same square footage from a state dinner to Linda's wedding to Lucy's wedding reception. Our chief tools are film, documents, and artifacts. Things like a wedding gown and the Bible he was sworn in on. What is the right mix? What tells the story? I went briefly into the dining room to see Lyndon, and there gathered around the table was a sort of assemblage that makes you know serious events are impending. McNamara and Katzenbach and Clifford and General Taylor and that wonderfully selfless man, Cy Vance, and old returnees, God bless them, back George Bundy, and Lodge and Ball, General Wheeler, Sam Berger, Dick Helms. I do not remember seeing Dean Rusk, but he must have been there, and staff members Walt Rostow and Tom Johnson and George Christian, and at the head, Lyndon, trying to pull from each all the answers to today's tough problems that he could. I waved at them and retreated. And in the treaty room, we continued our talking with the final general decision that they would have to start all over the design concept for the Great Hall. The pylons would go, the symmetrical row of round glass cages at the end would have to change to something more elastic. Buzz would have to come up with a more concrete, realistic script for Drexler to transform into an exhibit concept. And this within 2 weeks, because the laying of the conduits for the electric lines couldn't wait, and they would be bedded in marble. It was nearly 4 when they left, and I thanked Dr. Stanton and Leonard and Jack as lovingly as I could for giving me literally a day of their lives. And Lord knows we've only started, and we promised to meet again in something like 2 weeks. And then I worked with Ashton and Beth, and then we went down to the theater to sit on stools and lean over the tiny box-like screen and look at the raw film of Linda and Chuck's wedding. It was beautiful. The photography was a dream. And the script sounded good enough. I had read almost all of it, and I left the rest for Linda and Chuck and Bess to use their best taste and best judgment on, because I was catching the 7 o'clock plane for Texas. I went back upstairs at 6 and packed my straw bag, everything I thought I could work at home. I'd already kissed Linden goodbye in his bedroom and left close to 6:30 for Dulles Airport and took the Branny flight to Dallas. Lo and behold, Murdy and Philip Baldwin were aboard. And after I'd had dinner, I asked them to come up and join me, and we talked about the judgeship and Senator Yarber's intransigence. He absolutely will not confirm Philip. He insists on a man who was his campaign manager. And so there is a stalemate, and the docket is piling up. We talked of the possibility of another judgeship here in Washington, and Philip is interested. We talked of the graveyard at Scottsville. They've done some planting for me there. It was a pleasant flight and a relief after the hard day's thinking. We reached Dallas a little after 9 that time. Dale was there in the King Air, and we flew uneventfully to Austin, arriving at Lucy's and Pat's a little before 11 to look at Cherub asleep in his bed, talk to Lucy and Pat, and so to bed, wondering meanwhile how was the opening going at the Ford Theater in Washington, and as unsure and worried as I have ever been about the course the library is taking. I am trying to play a role in a field in which I have very little background and no authority. True, I have studied it for many trips and a good many hours, but it's a whole profession. The simple fact is, there isn't anybody but me. How could Lyndon? And so I have to.